So, a question on a request to clarify or talk a little more about causes and conditions. There's a simple question. I don't think I fully get it. Thanks. That's very sweet, I think, in a way that it reminds me of an exchange between the Buddha and Ananda at one point. Ananda came to the Buddha after having reflected on the teaching of dependent origination and said to the Buddha, "Oh, this dependent origination, it seems so clear to me and so helpful." And the Buddha said, "Don't say that, Ananda. It's a profound, deep teaching, and it's through not seeing this teaching that people stay stuck in suffering." And so, even recognizing that, God, I don't get cause, I don't get this conditionality thing. It's like, you're not alone. It's a deep, complex teaching. And the understanding of it develops and grows with the practice. And so, some patience with it. It's like there can be a kind of an incremental understanding, maybe a little bit of understanding that leads us to see our experience in terms of conditionality, and then a deeper understanding that supports our seeing it more deeply. So, I'll just say a couple of words about this and then point you to earlier in Feb from between February and July of 2021, I did a s extended series on conditionality, which included a discussion of dependent origination and then transcendent dependent origination. They're shorter talks because on the Thursday night it's a half an hour session for the talk and Q&A. So they're little bite-sized pieces, hopefully. And if you want just an overview, the very first talk is kind of an overview of conditionality. I put a link to that. To the Thursday night series in the document, in the retreat information document, and pointed to the dates of the conditionality series. So if that's of interest, that might support some additional learning. And yet, I think it really is in our practice that we learn. What I'll say briefly now is that all of our experience, what's arising right now in this moment, it's not random. It's not happenstance. It's conditioned based on circumstances, based on our conditioning from the past, our conditioning of culture, of our families, of our individual kind of experiences in life. All of what we have experienced in the past is kind of contributing to the stream of what's happening right now. So there are conditions from the past that are contributing, but then there are also factors contributing for right in the present moment. And so the key conditions contributing right in the present moment to what's unfolding is whether we're mindful or not. If we're not mindful, then what tends to unfold is our habitual conditioning. What tends to happen, and we continue to engage with our habitual conditioning. Often when we're not mindful, what happens is the playing out of our habitual conditioning. When we are mindful in the present moment, we might be able to see what's happening in the present moment and mindfulness. The quality of mindfulness with the perspective of curiosity about, well, what is this experience here? This arising of habitual pattern, frustration, confusion, anger, desire. What is that experience? As opposed to simply buying into the deluded nature of that experience and following through on it. And so there's a great possibility for the condition of mindfulness to shape the unfolding of our experience. And so we are shaped not only by our past conditions, but by what's happening right in the present moment. And this is where the Buddha pointed to the possibility of freedom. What's arising now can either have us back, you know, staying on our habitual patterns and tendencies of wanting what we like, wanting to get rid of what we don't like, versus seeing what's here and allowing, possibly having wisdom inform or make a different choice than our habits and patterns would. So I think that's all I'm going to say about causes and conditions right now. And then there was another question of kind of noticing the sense of self arising. This is a great kind of thing to see, actually, noticing the experience of a sense of self arising. And the question that came up with this was, is self a mental formation? Yes, self is also a mental formation. The sense of self, what we think of as self, is simply a congealing of a mental formation that is dependent on conditionality. So the sense of self is a mental formation. So that means that the sense of self, when it's arising, can shape our experience. So the sense of self, the feeling of self, it's not nothing. You know, when we say, oh, self, you know, we say it doesn't exist. Well, it's not what we think it is. It's not a thing that's persisting through time. But all mental formations have this capacity to affect the unfolding stream of what happens to us, as I just mentioned. So I guess I am going to talk about conditionality a little more here. As I just mentioned, you know, the arising of awareness and wisdom in the moment can shape what happens in subsequent moments. If frustration is arising in the present moment, that can shape what happens in subsequent moments. If a sense of self is arising in this moment with the sense of I'm going to do something, and there's a following through on that I'm going to do something, that's going to shape what happens next. It's not an actual kind of existent thing, I, self, me. It's a process. It's just another mental formation. It's just another tumbling on of experience that is misinterpreted as a me, as a sense of, as a who I am. And so, yes, self is a mental formation, and really useful to notice it when it happens. So one of the ways that we can really begin to explore the teaching on not self is to explore what we take to be self. When it feels like there's a sense of self there, what is that experience? We're exploring the mental formation. We're exploring the arising of conditioning that we are interpreting as me. And so this is one of the best ways to begin to understand the teaching of not self, to be really curious about what we think of as self. What is that? What is it that we're taking to be self? And starting to see, for me, some of the early kind of understandings around not self was that, you know, it seemed like there were a lot of different senses of self. You know, sometimes it was like the self that was the, you know, really analytical one who thought about things and had a very clear mind. And sometimes it was the sense of, you know, being a like playful little kid or something, like not much analysis in there. And it's like these two senses of self, as I felt them arise and kind of the sense of that, and then watched one of them disappear and then another one appear in the next split second, and seeing they were completely unrelated, completely different causes and conditions leading to one versus leading to the other, began to undermine the belief that that it was me. It's just, it really became much more clear that this is just a sense arising based on conditions. So observing that sense of self, not to have the idea of, oh, if I feel like a sense of self, that means I'm not seeing not self. No, you're seeing the arising of the mental formation that is interpreted as self. That is what is arising in this moment. That's what needs to be seen and understood as a phenomena arising now. There's another kind of question connected to the sense of self coming in practice. I was focusing on letting awareness be broad, whatever came to it, and then started zoning out and noticing didn't seem to help much. I assume noticing the kind of the zoning out experience, you know, that's when there's a kind of a zoning out state, that may be the best thing to try to connect to. It's like, oh, this is what it's like to zone out. Sometimes we could be trying to notice some particular experience, or think we should be experiencing specific sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, when the mind in a zoned out state is kind of more in a place of withdrawal from sense impression sometimes. So there is a way to just know that zoned out state. But in this case, the person decided to choose to focus on objects of awareness, you know, to bring in a practice, to bring in some tools. Okay, I'm going to direct the attention to actual body sensations or something. And then there was a recognition that that was a sense of self choosing to do that. So there was a kind of a sense of recognizing, oh, I'm choosing to do that. So that's recognizing the sense of self right there. So it's not something that we have to like stop doing anything there. It's but the very fact that you notice that kind of that sense of self, or the sense of I'm choosing something, that actually is kind of a beautiful kind of seeing. And then the question followed for this person: can you speak to that kind of me choosing something to pay attention to versus an experience of a flowing sort of awareness, which feels, this person said, which feels more like an organic, easeful, and gentle state for me when it's available? And I would say that possibly in that flowing state where it feels like what the experience is, that it feels like experience is coming to awareness. There's a receiving, a flow, not something that we have to try to direct attention to. It's just a very natural, as this person says, organic. Then that, at least that sense of self as a chooser, as a doer, is more quiescent in that time. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's not a sense of self there, because at least in my own experience, that place of receptivity, it can at times be very transparent, no sense of self in there at all. But at times what it feels like is this receiving experience is happening to me. So that's, I think of that as a kind of a subtler flavor of the sense of self. There's a teaching that the Buddha offers, a three-part kind of reflection on not self, and sometimes he flips it around and points to, you might be taking as self, this is mine, this is who I am, this is myself. But normally the reflection is, one should reflect about experience. This is not mine. This is not who I am. This is not myself. And for a while, exploring those three, I was clear on the mine part. The experience of mine felt pretty clear. And I think that actually the order of these three is successive levels of subtlety in terms of the sense of self. And so we may have really the sense of my ownership of some object in the world, or my mind state. This is my practice. This is my fear. Whatever. There's a sense of ownership is one experience, one expression of how we identify. And so noticing that, and when that's happening in terms of exploring the sense of self, when the feeling of mine is there, oh, really feels like this thing is mine. The second aspect, and this is my own understanding of these three. I haven't seen an elaboration on this in the suttas anywhere, but this was my own reflection on using these three. This is not mine. This is not who I am. This is not myself. Using these three as a reflection on my own experience, this is how I came to understand it. So I'm offering my own understanding here. I just want to make that clear. I don't know if this is what the Buddha meant, but it has been useful. This understanding has been useful for me and seems to have been useful for others as well. So there's that first one of mine. The second one is this is not who I am, or on the flip side, the feeling of this is who I am. The I, as we could say, as the subject of the sentence, the doer. I act. When the I is a subject of the sentence, there's usually an action that comes with it. And so that framing of I in the sense of being an agent, feeling like there's an agency, the feeling of I choose, I act, I decide, I engage, that feeling of I as the doer. Now that's connected to this feeling of I'm choosing to pay attention to something, right? That's that feeling of the sense of self. So that sense of self as the chooser, as the doer, as the decider, that to me was also relatively clear at certain points. It felt like I was acting, like in this example, yeah, I'm the one choosing to pay attention to an object. So that's another way that sense of self can be felt and explored. So noticing that quality, what does it feel like when it feels like there's a sense of self who is in charge of doing things? What does that feel like? And the third one is describe, this is not myself. And that language is kind of the self as the me, the object of the sentence, the one that things happen to, as opposed to being the one in charge. This for me was, it was a subtler experience and much more. It became clear at some point. At one point I began to be really clear that I was not doing the mindfulness. I wasn't the one that was making it arise. I wasn't choosing for it to continue. It was continuing on its own momentum. Causes and conditions were supporting the momentum of mindfulness. I wasn't making it happen. So I could see that level of self not there. I could know that it wasn't me in charge. It certainly wasn't mine to do anything with. But it felt like it was happening to me. And I actually went and reported this to my teacher, and I said, I can see it's not, I'm not doing it, but I can't see through this me business, I can't see through it. And he said, just notice the me, just again, just notice the experience of how the sense of self is manifesting. And so in that place of, in this situation where we are in that kind of flow of experience. It doesn't feel like I'm in charge. It just feels like a flow. There may still be a subtle sense of, yeah, it's happening to me. I mean, who else would it be happening to? It's just causes and conditions tumbling on. There doesn't actually have to be a witness or a receiver. Mindfulness is awareness awares, as I said this morning. Perception perceives, knowing knows. So, but the feeling of the me, just knowing that, oh, it feels like it's happening to me. That's the experience that's happening in the moment. That's the mental formation that's happening in the moment. It doesn't mean that there is a me here pervading, always there to receive. It's the experience that's being constructed in that moment, that it feels like a me. It's an arising in the moment, a mental formation in the moment. Ooh. We don't have that much time left. There were a couple more thoughts that I wanted. One thing, I'll just try to say this briefly, as briefly as some in terms of something that might be relevant or useful. There were several questions about integrating this practice with other practices. And this often comes up at the end of this kind of retreat. It's like, wow, you know, this is really interesting, this kind of practice. And maybe even having discovered at times that, you know, so at least certainly I discovered that when I turned to another practice or when practice habits came up in while doing this practice, there was a lot more ease with those practice habits. And so I got interested in that integration. So there are different ways we could talk about this practice being integrated with other practices. One might be that this practice is kind of the main focus, and that's kind of where you incline the mind towards, just the receiving, just knowing, yep, this is what's happening. This is the attitude, not trying to direct the attention. But there may be times when something gets challenging and we explore the possibility of notice the challenge. You know, can I be aware of the challenge? But we find that we get caught in that challenge. At that point, all of your other practices are fair game. You know, whatever practices that you have that are supportive for you to settle the mind, whether that's taking a walk in nature or doing metta practice or a focused practice or useless gazing that I talked about before, you know, whatever practices that might support you to find balance again, bring them in to help the mind come to the place of being able to be balanced. And then shifting back to the receptivity. So that would be if you're using the receptive awareness practice as the primary practice. On the flip side, you might be using another practice as a primary practice. And for myself, at one point, I was doing concentration practice as my primary practice. And yet I found at times when the mind got all kind of tied up in knots around concentration, It was helpful for me to step back to just receive, just like relax and let things be, to let my mind unwind from its kind of way in which it got knotted up in doing concentration practice. So I found that helpful as a kind of a balance for the kind of focused kind of attention. And through that exploration of kind of backing off and like, what would happen in this practice? I was doing concentration for a long stretch of time in a silent retreat container at the forest refuge. And I would find that, you know, after 3 or 4 days, the mind would get pretty tied up in knots because there was a lot of kind of striving in there and old habits of focus, old habits of greed around concentration connected to history. So it, hard not for those things to come up. And I wasn't doing in particular, well, let's check the attitude. I thought my instruction was stay with the object, you know, and so I was missing the attitude. And so I would practice with that for a few days. The mind would get tied up in knots and I'd go, okay, I'm going back to awareness practice. Let the mind relax. And then when I started the concentration practice up again, after, you know, a day or so of doing the open awareness practice, the first few sittings were so easy. It was like the relaxation, the open awareness practice had created the conditions for the mind to just be able to, yeah, there's a breath. That's easy to be with. So the attitude in the mind was skillful. And it was very easy to be with the breath for a little while, and then the mind would start getting tight again. And so at that point, I decided to interweave the two practices more fully, to check the attitude a little more frequently in the concentration practice, to step back when it felt like the mind was getting tight immediately. As soon as it felt like the mind was getting tight, I let relaxation of mind be primary. And so the two practices then began to interweave for me, much more naturally and much more organically. So I would say that the tool of relaxation, receiving, and checking the attitude, those three pieces can be integrated with any kind of meditation practice. The relaxation will support the mind to be able to meet whatever kind of practice or whatever kind of experience. So, for instance, with something like metta practice, we can relax to begin and then begin saying the metta phrases, and then the instruction with the metta practice is, notice how those phrases affect the system. It's a reflective practice, and so we bring those thoughts into the system. May I be happy? And then we check in and can receive. What's the impact? What's the effect of that wish on the system? So that receptive quality, receiving, so saying the phrase and then stepping back and receiving. How did that land? Can be done with the breath as well. It's like we might think of aiming the attention at the breath, kind of holding on, finding, looking at all the little pieces, or we might explore the possibility of kind of narrowing the field of what we're attending to the breath, but then just allowing what the breath is to be known, letting the breath be received, as opposed to trying to look for specific detail. That receptivity for me has been very helpful in pretty much any form of meditation practice. And so there are aspects of this kind of practice that I feel I've carried into whatever kind of practice that I'm doing. So those are three different ways of kind of thinking about this practice integrated with other practices. And then I want to open it up to, just for the last few minutes, questions. Oh, so what do I call this practice? I tend to call this practice, Sayadaw, I think, just calls it mindfulness practice or awareness practice. I tend to call it receptive awareness practice. But yeah, there's not particularly a name for it. That's just what I call it, receptive awareness practice.